All right. It is 3:19 on Friday, March 5th. I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Members present are Representative Kaufman, Representative McCarty, Representative Schrage, and myself, Chair Sponholz. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Thanks so much to our secretary today, Leah Fraser, and our LIO moderator, Tom Raymond. So we are holding today's meeting and a combination of teleconference and in person. So for those that are speaking, if everybody can introduce yourself, say your name at the beginning of your comments, just so everybody knows who is doing the speaking, and will help make it easier for our secretary to keep accurate minutes as well. So in order to keep the teleconference moving smoothly, those that are online, if you can mute your phones when you're just listening, and that will help preserve the audio quality. So we have a full agenda today, even on a Friday afternoon. This is the way we roll in labor and commerce. First up is an introductory hearing for HB 99, which relates to the State Physical Therapy and Occupational Therapy Board. Second is an introductory hearing of House Bill 45, an act related to a presumption of compensability for workers' compensation claims for contagious diseases, particularly salient right now. Third, we will hear and consider more of the governor's appointees. We intend to forward these appointees that we're hearing today at our next meeting on Wednesday, March 10th. If members have concerns with any appointees or would like to hear from them again, please let the co-chairs know 24 hours before our next meeting. Lastly, we will forward some of the appointees we heard on Wednesday forward for a vote in a full session. I will call a brief at ease to allow members who are participating via teleconference to come join us in Barnes 124 to sign the paperwork when that moment comes, when that time comes. All right, so our first order of business is an introductory hearing for HB 99 relating to occupational therapy. First, we're going to hear from Representative Klayman and his aide, Joey Bosworth, for an introduction of the bill and a sectional analysis, and then we'll have some testimony, and we've got folks available to answer questions, including Mr. Alex Kay, the Alaska president of the American Physical Therapy Association, and Dr. Leanne Carruthers, governmental affairs liaison for the American Physical Therapy Association. So we're going to get started. Representative Klayman, you want to put yourself on the record and introduce your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Labor and Commerce Committee. Thank you for hearing House Bill 99. My name is Matt Klayman, representative for House District 21, and I'm carrying this bill at the request of the Alaska Physical and Occupational Therapy Association. House Bill 99 amends the governing statutes for physical therapists, physical therapy assistants, occupational therapists, and occupational therapy assistants practicing in Alaska. The changes it makes are designed to bring Alaska statutes in line with national standards and terminology, and overall make the administrative experience of these professionals smoother and up to date. This bill is supported by the State Physical Therapy and Occupational Therapy Board, which believes House Bill 99 will help the board in its work to protect the public. A letter stating that support is in your bill packet. Currently, physical therapists, physical therapy assistants, occupational therapists, and occupational therapy assistants are represented by the State Physical Therapy and Occupational Therapy Board. This board is made up of one physician, three physical therapists, two occupational therapists, and one member of the public. The first change made by this bill is to remove the physician from this board and replace them with another occupational therapist, thereby balancing the representation of the professionals on the board. There is good reason for this change. When this statute was originally written, the work of physical and occupational therapists required referral by a physician. This has not been the case in Alaska for more than 30 years. House Bill 99 also enables the board to discipline a therapist who commits infractions under Alaska Statute 8.84.120, such as conviction of a felony, gross negligence, or abuse of alcohol. Currently, the board has the ability to revoke or deny a license based on infractions, but has no ability to discipline. This bill also clarifies the language and the requirements for those therapists who receive their training outside of the United States, ensuring that their training is equivalent to a United States professional physical therapy training program and also exempting therapists trained in an English language program from having to take an English proficiency test. Furthermore, this bill updates language in Alaska statute that references an accrediting entity that no longer exists and makes the language more general, allowing the state board to designate the appropriate accrediting entity as needed. Several other updates to terminology are made to update the language. House Bill 99 does not constitute a restructuring of the relevant statute, but it contains a number of long-awaited changes. This is a way to make it easier for professionals to do business in Alaska. And with that, I'll pass you off to Joy Bosworth, who can walk you through the sectional analysis.
Thank you, Representative. My name is Joey Bosworth, and I'm staff here in the office of Representative Matt Klayman. Section 1 of House Bill 99 removes the seat for a physician and balances out the board with three physical therapists or physical therapy assistants and three occupational therapists or occupational therapy assistants, along with one public member, to make up the seven-member board. It also changes the term physical therapy assistant to physical therapist assistant in this section and throughout the entire statute. This change is to conform to the industry title used nationally. Section 2 allows the board to have a broader authority over what entities will have accreditation oversight over physical therapy and occupational therapy education programs. Some of the accrediting entities listed in the statute are now either renamed or no longer exist, making that statute obsolete. Section 2 removes language from the statute relating to additional supervised field work that occupational therapists must complete, as these requirements are covered by the accrediting bodies. Section 3 changes the section headline from trained to educated. New language is added that requires foreign educated physical therapists or physical therapy assistant students to have attended a substantially equivalent educational program that is accredited by a U.S. accreditation entity that has been approved by the board. Outdated and obsolete language is removed that can be found on page 4, lines 3 through 9 of this bill. Added to subsection 3 of this section is language that would require that a physical therapist or physical therapist assistant pass a test demonstrating competency in the English language only if their program was taught in a foreign language. Subsection 4 requires that a foreign educated applicant is a legal alien or U.S. citizen. Subsection 7 requires them to pay the required fee and meet any other qualifications for or licensure set by the board under 884.10 subsection B. All the above changes in Section 3 are replicated for occupational therapists or occupational therapy assistants on page 4, lines 27 through 31, and over to page 5, lines 1 through 22. Section 4 makes conforming terminology changes. Section 5 makes conforming terminology changes as well. Section 6 makes conforming terminology changes, and Section 7 changes language that would now require that a limited permit is valid for 120 consecutive days. Section 8 allows only one limited permit per 12-month period. Section 9 updates additional licensure terminology. Section 10 adds disciplinary action as a possibility to actions a board might consider for an infraction of their licensure and updates terminology in Item 7 and states in Item 9 that failure to comply with the law or regulations or order of the board might result in disciplinary action or suspension of a license. Section 11 adds updated credentialing and terminology. Section 12 updates terminology. And Section 13 adds a new paragraph defining the updated term physical therapist assistant. Section 14 updates definitions in criminal law and sexual assault statute. Section 15 updates terminology under definitions in child protection statute. Section 16 repeals subsection 7, which is the definition using an outdated term of physical therapy assistant. According to Ledge Legal, when the actual term used for the definition is being changed, the entire citing must be repealed. The new definition is set out on page 8, section 13, lines 11 through 14. Section 17 sets out the applicability clauses for licensure for Sections 2 and 3 of this Act, and for Sections 7 and 8. Section 18 transitions language for the board vacancy and appointments for the PT/OT board, physical therapy or occupational therapy board, and states that the changes do not apply to current licensees until it is time for the licensure renewal, and then all changes to the law will apply.
All right, thank you very much for that introduction and sectional Gentlemen, are there any questions for the bill's sponsor before we do some invited testimony? Are there any questions from members online? Oh, and I need to recognize that Representative Snyder joined us at 3:26. All right. Oh, Representative. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Through the chair, I would like to hold any questions until after hearing testimony. It may be answered in the testimony.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, if you don't have a question, then you don't have to comment, Mr. McCarty. Thank you. All right. All right. With that, we will move on. I think first up, we've got Alec Kay with the Alaska Association of Physical Therapy Association.
Hello. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of this bill, HB 99. My name is Alec Kay, and I'm current president of the Alaska chapter of the American Physical Therapy Association, representing about 450 physical therapists and physical therapist assistants. This bill is largely one of modernizing language, getting us up to speed in terms of terminology and eliminating some antiquated language in terms of accrediting bodies, as well as the permitting process. The concept for this bill largely came from the state licensing board, as they felt it would help them be able to do their function in terms of protecting the public, and we support it as well in that direction, as well as just being a clear document for enforcing the practice and for the public. I'd be happy to take any questions, and I appreciate this opportunity to speak in support of HB 99.
All right, thank you very much for your testimony today, Mr. Kay. Are there any questions for Mr. Kay from members online? All right, I asked, and Mr. McCarty, Representative McCarty, you're free to ask your question.
Thank you, through the chair. So, Mr. Kay, you're stating that this is supported by the board, and you're president of the association. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so is this supported by the association?
Yes, it is. I'm speaking on behalf of the association, and it was sort of originated mainly by the state licensing board, right?
Okay, thank you.
It's always good news when the state licensing board and the professional association agree on something. And just for the committee, I'm going to try to go back and forth between giving folks on the phone the opportunity to ask questions first and people in the room, sort of back and forth. So that was my reasoning for going to folks on the phone. We're operating, for those that are listening, we're operating in a bit of a hybrid right now, so we're adapting our committee culture a little bit as we're working through that process. All right. Are there any other questions? All right, Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, is there any risk in removing the physician from the board? I respect that it may be an oddball on the board, but just since this is, near medical, is there a benefit of having a physician on the board, and is that typical in other states? Is it typical makeup of the board to not have a physician in this day and age? Thank you.
Would you like me to take that question?
Go ahead.
Yes, please.
Okay. The fact that we have a physician on our board is really a remnant of a time when physical therapists were functioning under the American Medical Association, and when the board and licensure was established in Alaska, that was the case. That is no longer the case, as we're, a separate and identifiable profession, and it's not typical to have a physician on other health professional boards. I actually served on the licensing board for 4 years, and in the mid-2000s, and during that time, it was very rare for us to actually have that seat filled. And when it was filled, it was rare to have that position attend our meeting. I can't speak for the current function of the board and the position involved, but there wasn't much oversight needed, or it didn't really add much to what we were doing, because everything we were doing had to do with physical and occupational therapy. And we actually have in our support packet a letter from a physician supporting this particular part of the bill, acknowledging that it's not necessary.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair.
Go ahead, Representative Klayman.
Representative Kaufman, through the chair, a couple of years ago we actually passed a statute for an optometry board, and the optometry board specifically does not have a physician or an ophthalmologist on the optometry board, just as an example of a healthcare board that doesn't have a physician on it.
Historically, many of our healthcare boards originally had physicians on them, and the practice has been to move away from that over time as the healthcare professions have diversified and professionalized. Physical therapists in the state of Alaska, you are not required to have a physician's referral to see a physical therapist. So there is no, in fact, referral relationship required anymore. So I think it makes a lot of sense to make this modernization. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Kay. And next up, we have Leanne Carruthers with the American Physical Therapy Association. Did you have any testimony you wanted to add, Ms. Carruthers?
No, thank you, ma'am. I'm here for questions.
All right, thank you. We also have online Sharon Walsh, who's deputy director with the department. Ms. Walsh, did you have anything you wanted to add?
No, not at this time. Thank you.
All right. Are there any additional questions from members of the committee? And I'll start with the room first. Nope. All right. No. Anybody online have any additional questions? All right. Seeing none, we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside. We're going to bring it up again on Friday, March 12th for public testimony and committee action at that time. Amendments must turn into the co-chairs at least 24 hours before that hearing to be considered on Friday. Thanks. So next up on the agenda is an introductory hearing for House Bill 45, an act relating to the presumption of compensation for workmen's compensation claims for contagious diseases. We have a few folks on the line to answer questions before I invite the bill's sponsor to speak. We have Charles Collins, who is director of the Division of Workers' Compensation, and Scott Jordan, the director of the Division of Risk Management with the Department of Administration. And the bill sponsor is Representative Josephson. You want to introduce yourself and introduce the bill? No? All right. Looks like we don't have Representative Josephson on the line. We're going to take a brief at ease while we track him down. For Representative Josephson, I think it might make sense if we take up one of the appointees, and we're going to go ahead and start with Nicholas Miller, who is an appointee to the nominee for the Marijuana Control Board. Mr. Miller, are you on board? Online?
Madam Chair, yes, I'm here.
All right, excellent. You want to go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and explain why you're qualified and interested in serving on the Marijuana Control Board?
Through the chair, my name is Nick Miller. First, I would like to thank you for taking the time to speak with me this afternoon. I'm here because I would like to continue to serve on the Marijuana Control Board. I believe there is still work to be done on the regulations, and I really enjoy going through the public process. My past experiences have allowed me to provide meaningful input to the Marijuana Control Board and to promote honest and respectful communications between the board, public, staff, and industry. And I look forward to answering any questions you may have for me.
All right. Thank you very much. You want to talk a little bit about your background, and what about your background prepared you for this role?
Through the chair, I worked in the telecommunications field for 20 plus years in Alaska, and presented and at hundreds of community council meetings, assembly meetings, planning and zoning meetings. So it gave me a lot of experience just going through the public process, you know, taking public input, considering that with the projects we were working, and, you know, most times coming up with good compromises. As far as the industry goes, my wife and I have three licenses. Our business has been open for 3 years now. So I was appointed to the industry seat, so I get to see it from the industry side to provide input from that perspective.
All right. Thank you very much. Are there any questions from members of the committee that are on the telephone? All right. Are there any questions from members of the committee that are in the room? Representative McCarty.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Miller, how long have you been on the board currently? Hello?
Through the chair, I was originally appointed in 2016.
Okay.
Follow up?
And so since 2016, what's the evolution and needs of the industry that you see today?
Through the chair, there are several processes, I guess, as an example, through transportation, that could be adjusted that would better, I think, serve the industry and the public, that add a lot of time and expense to a business that are really unnecessary and don't provide any public safety or health or safety benefits.
You have a follow-up?
Are there any others? Yes, I'm sorry.
There are small others, but really I think transportation is on the top of the list right now through the chair. I apologize.
Okay, thank you.
So the chair is curious about what transportation-related regulations you think are burdensome.
Through the chair, if someone is traveling from Fairbanks to Anchorage or from Fairbanks to Kenai, most times it has to be a direct trip, which means you have to leave Fairbanks and make all of your stops in Anchorage and then drive straight through to Kenai without any overnight stops. And that, you know, becomes a safety issue and sometimes a burden because you can't stay in a hotel overnight. Now, those are being addressed and being, I would say, fixed. But, you know, it's those type of issues that that we're trying to, I guess, tighten up in the regulations a bit.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a fair point. That would be a very long drive in one day, Mr. Miller, particularly in the winter time when it's dark and the light is low. I am curious. I think there's some discussion about changing the regulations on the amount of THC and edibles up from 5 to 10, and wondering kind of what the thinking is in that decision.
Through the chair, there's currently a draft regulation out now, and we should be reviewing public comment at the next meeting. The thinking right now has just been the industry and consumers are asking for higher limits of THC and edibles, and, you know, from a, I guess, a principled standard, it's we're not increasing the amount of THC a person can purchase when they come into the facility. It's really just adjusting the amount of THC that's in a package. So if someone wanted to buy 10 milligrams of edibles, they could buy one piece instead of two pieces of candy packaged separately.
So you're increasing, though, the amount of THC that is in essentially kind of one dose of an edible. If you were a consumer and you wanted to consume 10 milligrams, couldn't you just take two bites? as opposed to changing the regulation?
You could, through the chair, you could eat two cookies or two capsules, however, whatever product you're purchasing. But the overall limit of THC that a consumer can purchase per day is not increasing.
Has there been concern, any concerns in other states with, you know, accidental sort of overconsumption of edibles at those higher rates? I know that part of the rationale with making that change was so that our state's regulations would be in line with other states, which there's some merit to that argument, but has there been any, you know, accidental overdoses or problems that have come along with that in other states?
Through the chair, I have seen some data from, I believe it was the Anchorage Health Department, where they had some statistics from other states. Unfortunately, the state they had statistics from, I believe it was Michigan, but their limits are 10 times what we currently have today and would be five times what we're proposing. But I believe the number was there was a 10% increase in overconsumption. I don't think it was accidental consumption, but where someone became uncomfortable and they had to call for assistance from a hospital.
So in Michigan, you can buy an edible that has 50 milligrams of THC in it? Is it milligrams or micrograms? I'm not an expert.
That's through the chair, it is milligrams. And yes, today you can purchase an edible that has 50 milligrams.
Well, let's just hope we don't go that far in the state of Alaska, Mr. Miller.
Through the chair, I would not disagree.
All right. Are there any other questions from members of the committee for Mr. Miller while we've got him? All right. Mr. McCarty?
Mr. Miller, the tax that's put on the industry, how are you seeing that in helping those that have cannabis challenges, dependence, or abuse? Do you see that trickling back to help these individuals, or are there still a need there?
Through the chair, personally, I have not seen a benefit. I don't think that the state does a good job of letting the public know where those dollars are going. I know we're doing some educational things for the youth and things like that, but I personally don't know of any programs that the state has funded back into to that particular section.
Actually, there is the marijuana tax funds are not used for addiction treatment in the state of Alaska. There, half of them go into the general fund and the other half go into prevention efforts. Half of the prevention funds go into evidence-based after-school programs for at-risk youth in middle school, I believe. So, do you have another question, Representative McCarty?
Yes, the follow-up there is there anything that the board is doing to educate or promote that awareness?
Through the chair, in the past, we have had a report given at the Marijuana Control Board, typically from DHSS to talk about the programs that they're funding for the kids, and that's the reason I understood that part. So yes, the Marijuana Control Board does try to promote those activities and get it out to the public.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions? Any other questions on the phone?
Rep. Snyder might ask one quick question if there's still time.
Go ahead, Representative Snyder.
Thank you. Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Miller, I'm curious, would you have any thoughts you could share with us regarding the issue of on-site consumption? I know that's been a recent topic of debate. It seems to come up a lot at community council meetings, for example. Could you share a little bit of your thoughts on that?
Through the chair. I personally don't have much experience with on-site consumption. For better or worse, there was a establishment here in Anchorage a couple years ago that had it. I guess You know, I don't have strong feelings one way or the other. I guess what I do have strong feelings about is the fact that there is a local option, that the local communities get to choose if they will allow on-site consumption. But I haven't really ever been to one, and I don't have strong feelings either way.
Follow up?
Nope, that's good for me. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Thank you, Chair.
All right.
Representative Shoggy would like to get in the queue as well, if possible.
All right, go ahead, Rep. Shoggy.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask about, I've heard talk of a limited entry system for marijuana retailers, and I'm just wondering if that's an issue that's on your radar, and if you would care to share any thoughts on that matter.
Through the chair. The board has discussed it at a couple of past meetings. The board asked the industry association to do a survey of current licensees to really give the industry's opinion on this. And I believe those, they haven't provided that report yet, but I believe they will probably be providing it at the next Marijuana Control Board meeting. So it is definitely on our radar. You know, there are strong opinions both ways, but we'll just have to see how the survey turns out and if the board is interested in doing anything.
Follow up?
Would your preference to be to follow the results of the survey, or do you have personal opinions on that as well?
Personally, you know, I'm through the chair. Personally, I'm kind of, you know, let businesses run and be competitive and do what they need to do to stay that way. But it would really depend on the industry survey and public input. I do believe that the public is going to have something to say about it as well.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for your testimony and your willingness to engage in some detailed discussion. This is obviously an area of keen interest for a lot of Alaskans right now, and you're kind of right in the middle of a blossoming industry in our state, and there's a lot of questions that are still kind of open about how it is that we handle the marijuana industry. And so thanks for being willing to take on that work. I'm going to go ahead and open up public testimony on Nicholas Miller's nomination. Is there anybody online who would like to testify? Yeah?
Madam Chairwoman, this is Lacey Wilcox, if I would.
All right, Lacey Wilcox, go ahead.
Thank you. So for the record, my name is Lacey Wilcox. I'm the president of the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association, and I am representing that association today. And I'd like to offer a tiny bit of background for the benefit of the committee as to what this association is, since we are pretty new. The AMIA is the only statewide cannabis industry trade group. You can think of the CHAR for legal marijuana sales and cultivation and manufacturing. So our mission is to promote and advocate for a vibrant but reasonably regulated Alaska-based marijuana industry, and we serve to strengthen and enhance the network of connected, independent, informed, regionally and community-directed marijuana organizations. So just a little bit of background on what we are. The AMIA is the acronym, so I'll just use that one. The AMIA is pleased to offer our support for the reappointment of Nick Miller to the industry seat on the Marijuana Control Board. Mr. Miller holds, as he had said, three licenses in the Alaska cannabis industry, and some of those are not just in Anchorage, so he's got a rural off-the-road system perspective that we appreciate, and he does so with his wife. So in the statutorily set requirements for the seat, we consider him clearly qualified. Additionally, he is the founder of the Anchorage Cannabis Business Association and serves as that organization's president. And so he's deeply familiar with the issues around the Anchorage market, and we appreciate that from an industry statewide association perspective. It's very helpful. Mr. Miller also is recognized by most in industry as an affable peer and colleague and has carried a very diplomatic approach, which has led to some common sense regulations. As you said, there's still work to do, and we really hope for his reasonable approach to continue on that board. He seems to understand the issues and challenges that face both urban and rural markets. His experience will help guide the control board, ensuring small business owners can grow their operations efficiently and safely. And then specifically throughout the pandemic, he has maintained a very calm and thoughtful approach. They've definitely increased the amount of meetings they've had this year, most of them through Zoom. So the dedication and the ability to serve in that kind of more tricky situation that we're in is not without recognition. It's a lot of work. It's not an easy board. We are really grateful for the years of service that he has already put in, the efforts and achievements he has spearheaded during his time on the board. And we would consider him clearly the right choice, and he would garner broad approval within the industry itself. And I do believe that choosing a trusted industry member during this particularly difficult time economically is really probably the best way to ensure continued growth and improvement for these businesses. And I would just like to thank you, the committee, for the opportunity to provide this testimony, and thank you for your state service.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Wilcox on the phone? From any committee members in the room? All right. With that, thanks very much for your testimony. Is there anybody else on the line to testify? All right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. All right. And we're going to set aside the rest of our nominations and go back up to our bill hearing on House Bill 45. I believe that we have Representative Josephson on the line now to introduce his bill. You there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear, Representative Josephson. Go ahead.
Thank you. First, Madam Co-Chair, I would like to apologize to the committee for our delay in appearing. I apologize for that. My name is Andy Josephson. I represent House District 17. It's the UMed in Anchorage. Before you is House Bill 45. House Bill 45. The concept of House Bill 45 came from the March-April 2020 time period when two states in particular, to my memory, Michigan and Minnesota, led the nation in offering protections to first responders in the form of workers' comp benefits in situations where there was an emergency declaration called. As you, Madam Co-Chair, know in particular, because you were very involved in this, in late March, in the form of Senate Bill 241, which was our emergency declaration until November 15th, we did all sorts of things in what was an omnibus bill to protect Alaskans and offer them everything from a moratorium on rent, et cetera. And in that, the legislature adopted Amendment 5 in the House side, which offered workers' comp protection for those first responders, largely, who had suffered some exposure to COVID. Sadly, although we crafted it as well as we could, municipalities in particular, and maybe other employers, are litigating what we meant in that bill. They're asking for proof beyond what was intended that the exposure occurred at work. What House Bill 45 does is it does the following. It says, 100 years ago, now 103 years ago, there was an awful pandemic in the form of the Spanish flu. And now 103 years later, here we are. And so House Bill 45 is designed to say, after we're gone, there could be future pandemics. Invariably, there will be. And we want our first responders and also some other folks that may not have gotten the attention they deserved, like daycare workers and grocery workers, who are absolutely essential to making our lives better and allowing us to function. We want them to have the courage and the fortitude and the confidence that we have their backs collectively. And so it creates a presumption that is rebuttable by clear and convincing evidence. The presumption only exists during a time when an emergency declaration is declared. And it would provide workers' comp for folks who get a pandemic disease within 2 weeks, and they'd have to show that they had work-related interaction within 2 weeks prior to their diagnosis. That's essentially what this bill does. You know, one thing I would say is that fortunately, in Alaska, for example, and my staff, Elise Sorenberg, will put herself on the record and give you more detail, but we've done quite well here. Tragically, we've lost, I think, over 100 people, and others have gotten sick, and no doubt there will be some long haulers there. But for many people, they recover relatively quickly, and so the burden imposed by this benefit would not be enormous. And, you know, frankly, if it wasn't covered by workers' comp, it would be covered under a health policy if they had one through their employer, and that would generate its own cost to the employer. So that's the essence of the bill, and if I can answer any quick questions about it, I'll do that, and then I'll turn it over to Ms. Sorenberg.
All right, and thanks. Just a quick clarification. We've actually lost over 300 lives to COVID-19 in the state of Alaska, Representative Josephson. But I appreciate your interest in this issue. We did address it in SB 241 this last spring, but that did expire, as you noted, in November 15th. And we want to make sure that our frontline workers that we count on to care for us and to make sure we get food and are safe are also safe and taken care of if they do get sick. So I appreciate your introducing this bill. Are there any questions for Representative Josephson before we go to the sectional analysis and other presentation? All right, any questions from members of the committee that are on the telephone? All right, hearing none, Ms. Sorenberg, looks like you're up.
Hello, Chair Sponholz. For the record, Elise Sorenberg, staff to Representative Josephson. I will move through my presentation fairly quickly because the representative did a very good job of summarizing the bill. So on the first slide of the presentation, you'll see the background of COVID-19 and SB 241 that Representative Josephson just ran us through. And as the representative noted, that expired November 15th, 2020. Next slide is slide number two, the third slide after. So what is a presumption of compensability? So the workers' compensation system works well for tangible physical injuries. Certain occupational diseases and illnesses can be hard to identify, and it can be hard to know how these were contracted specifically. Presumption of compensability is a legal idea that certain occupational groups are more likely to contract certain diseases. It's a law that allows an assumption to be made that an illness is linked to the nature of someone's work. There are different kinds of presumptions. There are rebuttable presumptions, which is what we have in this bill before you, and there are non-rebuttable presumptions, and I will talk a little bit more about that moving forward. If a presumption exists, an impacted employee may receive workers' compensation unless their employer is successful at rebutting the claim. So the next slide, slide number four, is an analysis of SB 241 and how that compares to HB 45, the bill before you today. Representative Josephson covered most of this. HB 45 adds grocery clerks, teachers, and child care workers to the groups covered. It also allows the commissioner of the Department of Labor to identify groups we may not have noticed, groups who also are frontline workers who face similar risks. So we leave that up to the commissioner. HB 45, one thing that is different than SB 241 is in 241, it was rebuttable. And 241 was a non-rebuttable presumption. HB 45 is a rebuttable presumption, meaning an employer can say, I have proof that you, the employee, were being irresponsible. I can potentially rebut your claim. And also, the other major difference between 241 and 45 is rather than saying that someone is exposed at work, we say that someone has to be directly working in public. They have to be in direct contact with public at least 2 weeks before they contract the disease. Next slide, please. So here's the sectional analysis. Section 1 establishes the presumption and outlines metrics used to determine if the presumption exists. The presumption only applies if a disaster emergency is declared by the governor under the Alaska Disaster Act, AS 26.23.020C, meaning that technically, if we pass this bill into law today, it wouldn't have an effect right at this moment because we don't have a disaster emergency in place. And we do know that disaster declarations are limited in scope. We know that the legislature can terminate a declaration by the governor at any time. And we know that in theory, a governor's declaration cannot last more than 30 days without legislature approving. So this is very narrow in scope. This declaration for this presumption to apply would have to specifically do with contagious diseases. So it wouldn't just be any disaster declaration. It would be a disaster declaration related to a contagious disease. Subsection A of Section 1 outlines the metrics for establishing the presumption. It says you must be part of one of the professions listed, be diagnosed by a doctor or have positive lab result for whatever the illness happens to be, and you have to have that direct contact with the public, meaning that if you're not interacting with the public in your job, if you're in the back office, if you're working from home, if public's not visiting your office, then the presumption does not apply to you. Section 1B outlines the standard of clear and convincing evidence and lists the professions covered, and it also gives the commissioner the authority I talked about earlier. Section 1C provides definitions. A couple notes on the definitions. Child care workers are only those who are working in licensed facilities, facilities licensed by DHSS. So not in-home, small, non-licensed child care individuals. And firefighters, that category includes state and municipal firefighters, as well as individuals who are registered for purposes of workers' compensation in volunteer fire services. Section 2 is a retroactivity clause, and this only has to do for the workers who were previously covered in SB 241. This makes it retroactive to November 15th for those first responders and medical professionals. And then Section 3 is the effective date, and it has an immediate effective date. Next slide, please. So why these classes of workers? First responders are the first group that we'll talk about. This still covers EMTs, paramedics, firefighters, and peace officers. One thing we noted was that COVID has been the biggest cause of peace officer deaths this year, and that's really tragic. More police officers are dying from COVID than in direct field-related injuries or other or for other reasons. Another thing we came across was that there was a study showing COVID risks for firefighters and emergency medical workers in New York City, and they were quite a hot spot, but they were found to be 15% more likely to be infected during the first wave of COVID in New York. Next slide, please, about healthcare workers. this group has had a lot of attention, obviously, and there have been a lot more studies done about healthcare workers and their risks for contracting COVID. These are often the folks who have the most direct contact with COVID-positive patients and are providing treatment for individuals who are hospitalized with COVID. It's worth noting that in Alaska, in some information provided by the Department of Labor, medical worker claims made up the majority of time lost claims for workers' compensation, meaning that individuals who were working in the medical field were being required more frequently to go home in quarantine because of close contact. Next slide, please. Teachers and childcare workers. There was a belief early in the pandemic that children might not be as susceptible to the virus. And while it's still been found to be true that they're not as likely to get extremely sick, we now know that they do play a role in transmission of the virus. So, and that role is a little bit of a larger role than people thought at first. One thing to take into account with teachers, the Kaiser Family Foundation did a study noting that about a quarter of teachers were in a higher risk category, either due to age or medical conditions. So those high risk teachers would feel some nervousness about returning to the classroom. And in some places like Anchorage, schools have not been open, but again, this presumption is only for individuals who are working in person with people outside of their household. Childcare settings are a big concern as well, though we know that both in schools and childcare settings, if you do a good job mitigating, it's not going to be as big of an issue. Childcare settings, often you have low-wage workers without benefits, and what they do is really core to the functioning of our society. It allows people to go to work. And it's worth noting that all public health restrictions on child care facilities in Alaska were lifted pretty early on in the pandemic by Governor Dunleavy. And the last group, grocery store workers, this one's very clear as well, often low-wage jobs like child care workers. And there are studies out there saying that a high rate of symptomless COVID infection among grocery store workers exists. So next slide is the status of COVID-19 presumptions throughout the nation. I put this map together using data from a NCSL analysis that you have in your packet. HB 45, what we have before us, is similar to what has been passed into law in Vermont, except for Vermont is COVID-specific, not for all pandemics. On the chart, you'll notice that there are states in blue. States in blue are places that executive orders have been put into place. States in green, things have been put into place by those legislators in those states. And how states approach it is a little different in different places. Some places like California have very, very broad presumptions that would apply to all essential workers. And some places have more narrow ones that would only apply to healthcare workers or first responders. And with that, I don't have a slide on this, but I do have did want to touch on one thing. We became aware of an NCCI cost study that was done on this bill, and in that analysis, they have three hypothetical situations. So I did a little looking with what numbers are like in Alaska. And I'd like to note that the Department of Labor and Workforce Development got me a lot of interesting information, which I do believe you have in your packet as well at this point, about what COVID has looked like in the workplace in Alaska. And so in Alaska, the infection rate overall in December of 2020 was 5.9%, the lowest scenario analyzed in the NCCI analysis is 5%. So we'd be close to that lowest scenario. The other thing worth noting is that 5.9% is for the overall population. Department of Labor estimated that really only 1 in 12 COVID cases in Alaska was work-related based on work comp claims that have come in throughout 2020. And so far in 2020, only 3% of COVID cases have resulted in workers' compensation claims. And thank you so much. That concludes my presentation. Any questions?
All right. Thank you very much for that presentation, Ms. Thornburg. That was very interesting. We also have available online to answer any questions if members have them, Charles Collins, who's the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation, and Scott Jordan, who's the director of the Division of Risk Management. All right. Are there any questions for the bill's sponsor and or our experts that are online with the administration?
Rep. Snyder had a question, if I could get in the queue, please, Chair.
All right. Go ahead, Rep. Snyder.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Josephson, for this. This is good to see, and I know a lot of the folks have worked so hard for the past year in responding to this pandemic. Must be pleased about this. I was looking at the definition of grocery store in AS 44.25.048, and it's a pretty brief definition, and I'm just thinking and wanting to make sure that it applies to the variety of food retail stores that we see both in urban environments and rural communities in Alaska. Had you thought about that at all, or is it, just want to make sure we're covering our diverse scenarios here in the state?
Through the chair, Ms. Representative Snyder, I had not considered whether the definition would be expansive enough to cover the kinds of food dispensers that we have in Alaska. No, I haven't done that. Go ahead.
And through the chair, Representative Snyder, this is Elise Thornburg. Working with legal, the reason that this is the definition that was used is that is the only statutory definition that exists for grocery store, as far as we were able to find. That's the reason that that definition is used.
And understood. Thank you for that. It may be more of just a request to flag or for careful consideration. I would just hate to see some of our smaller stores, food stores, excluded if the interpretation was such, or if it happened to be a store that sold things in addition to food, making sure that that didn't cause a problem in my reading of the definition of grocery store. So thank you for considering that concern.
All right. Maybe you can address that in the next hearing that we have on this talk. But Representative McCarty, do you have a question?
I do. Through the chair, I understand that this is for contagious disease type thing that the governor has declared an emergency. And that emergency could be anywhere in Alaska. It doesn't have to be just the whole state of Alaska, or is it just emergency that affects the whole state?
You are, through the chair, Representative McCarty, Elise Thornburg, you are correct. So there could be a regional or a localized pandemic. So if there was an outbreak of some unknown contagious disease, say in Western Alaska, the governor can declare emergencies for regional or individual municipalities. And this would apply to those, so this, if it was to do with a contagious disease.
Follow up. So if, let's say, a community had a very common thing, August happens, schools open up, kids go to school, and people get sick because they're just sharing their heebie-jeebies. So influenza happens, and the community has a high rise of influenza that's is considered an intrusion, that a contagious disease category for that area, that this here would mean that the employers of that community would be up for potential worker comp claims because their employees are getting sick from influenza? Would that be a scenario?
Representative McCarty, through the chair, Elise Thornbrook, the governor has to have declared an emergency. So if there was something that was so severe that the governor had declared a disaster emergency, then that's a possibility. Probably for the common cold or the seasonal flu, it would be unlikely for a governor to declare a disaster emergency.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up?
Just a follow-up. So is there a definition in this process of a disaster emergency for contagious type things, what that entails?
Yes. So Representative McCarthy, through the chair, we are using the disaster emergency definition in the Alaska Disaster Act, and so that can be found in AS 26.23.020C. And I don't have the exact words of that in front of me right now, but that is the subsection relating to public health emergencies of the Alaska Disaster Act.
All right. It might be useful to get that definition to everybody so that we have that in front of ourselves when we consider the bill when we take up the bill again on final consideration. Maybe you can look that up and we can make sure that everybody on the committee has that information in advance. We'll make sure it gets distributed via email. I think it's a very good question. It seems unlikely that any governor and or the legislature also has the authority to declare a disaster would do so for flu. It's probably more likely in the state of Alaska would be something like tuberculosis or something like that. And if you were talking about a regional outbreak, it seems more likely. And you could imagine a scenario where you had tuberculosis running through communities where there wasn't running water and it became rampant and there could be a problem, for example, that this might apply to specifically. All right. Representative McCarty. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, and I guess I'll go to Representative Josephson on this. One thing I'm concerned with is that it puts the employer in the case in a situation of proving a negative, and that's tough. I'm just afraid that it kind of opens up a door that is once opened, then it may put employers in a bad way, especially considering that we are. You know, we're still coming out of the economic effects of all of this, so I worry about that burden. I wonder if it opens the employers to liability if it can be shown that an employee was deemed by this standard to have caught the disease at work, if then anybody that came down with it, that came in, let's say, to buy groceries and happen to get sick, could say, well, that's proof that I caught it there too. And also, there's high-risk groups that are more susceptible to this, and I wonder if it can open the door to discrimination where an employer would not want to have somebody there that could maybe be more susceptible to it. And then, of course, the shared costs that go across the entire business community, because insurance is a risk and cost-sharing tool. So when I think of all of that, I just think of a lot of uncertainty that that this represents. I can kind of respect what you're trying to do with, covering people, but on the other hand, I wonder as well, is there maybe some of these jobs have paid sick leave, and so would this even be required?
And all right, there's quite a few questions there, Representative Compton. Maybe let's let the bill sponsor take some of those on.
Sure.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, Representative Coffin, those are all good questions. I will tell you that starting in around 2008, and I'm darn if it's not eight spot on, it's within a year of that, the legislature and the governor at the time passed a bill sponsored by Nancy Dahlstrom, who's currently our corrections commissioner. And the bill said that firefighters and related professions who had exposure to carcinogenic material could receive workers' comp upon sufficient sort of prima facie evidence that that's where it occurred. And it's not fantastic coverage. It's a 60-month bill, and you have to prove up, I think, relatively quickly that I'm trying to remember the details, but essentially it's not that generous of a provision. But the point I'm trying to make is there is some history in the Alaska law for coverage of something that is unseen. So that has already been sort of made clear. The second thing is, as we noted, there are a number of states, and you see that in the PowerPoint, who are doing this very thing. I mean, the difficulty with not covering this is we're effectively saying that unless it's an injury, a head injury, or an injury where someone clearly broke a bone or there was bleeding or something that was obvious, that we're simply not going to cover it. And I think the failure to cover these sorts of exposures might have a chilling effect. It might cause people to not want to enter that profession. It might cause people to not want to go to work, especially if you're a grocery worker earning $10 an hour. We've seen that that's essential kind of work. So, you know, and I think that we've seen what Ms. Soren Burke noted, which was that, for example, it's sort of indisputable that in the last year there have been more deaths to police officers from this sort of COVID exposure than any other source. So I take your point. I think that luckily, particularly in Alaska, where there hasn't been significant exposure and we've had relative success, as harmful as it's been, that the sharing of this burden through workers' comp stakeholders, that is, most people have to purchase workers' comp, employers, et cetera, would soften the blow, and there would be sort of a shared burden of it. So I take your point on that. Relative to whether someone would say, oh, I heard that there was workers' comp exposure, and therefore my sickness must have come at Safeway grocery store as well, I just don't know. I just don't know that that's likely to happen. So those are my thoughts.
I think it might be useful as well in a future hearing if we could bring Lori Wing Heyer, who's the director of the Division of Insurance, in to talk about, to sort of answer some questions about how she sees this working as well. And I'll just note that we did share after our last committee meeting, I think it was this morning at 11:15 a.m., my co-chair shared some information about workers' comp rates in the state of Alaska, which have actually declined pretty significantly over the last few years. The good news for us is that this bill would only apply in the event of a public health disaster, which I think this is the first time that that's ever happened statewide and in the history of our state, and hopefully it will never happen again, although it seems less likely as we look to the future. Are there other questions for the bill's sponsor today? Representative McCarty?
Thank you. Through the chair, I have a couple of questions. One, it's been come up several times about the numbers of people who've been affected here in the state or a number of workers, but there's not been definitive numbers on page 2 of the bill of these workers that might have been affected in the past year. And if you come back with some numbers of the, I think, you know, that's been in the state, I'd appreciate that. And a follow-up.
Actually, I'll ask the bill sponsor to answer that question about the number of cases related to COVID, because I think that that was referenced early in the presentation, and then I'll let you have a full follow-up. Sorry.
Well, I thought that was a national number.
Ms. Sorenberg.
Representative McCarty, through the chair, I think actually the Department of Labor might be the best people to answer this question because they have a pretty thorough report that is included in your packets about the numbers of different cases of COVID in these occupations in Alaska.
All right, great.
If that's what you're asking for.
Yeah, Charles Collins with the Workers' Compensation Division is online. Mr. Collins, are you online?
This is Charles Collins with Alaska Workers' Compensation. I am online.
All right. Can you answer the question?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty. So we have tracked claims, and by claims, I mean if somebody sent in a report of injury to the division, and we had through the end of last week, we'd had 2,386 claims reported. Not all of those were approved, shall we say. 254, just about 10% or so, were denied. But of the 2,000, approximately 2,000 of them that were reported, we had to break those out a little bit. And as you spoke about there, it's tough to get to, like, grocery stores and stuff. So we broke them out as best we could into larger groups. Especially concentrating on first responders and like seafood processors and some of those kind of things. So with that, I would say, if you needed some numbers exactly out of that, we would be able to parse that out. It might take me a day or two. But if there's a general question, I'd be more than glad to answer to it.
Does that answer your question, Representative McCarty?
I would be interested in the numbers to understand how much of an impact this would be just on a large realm that COVID has been to the state. And also the question and the aspect of the differentiate like an airborne pathogen type of thing that's contagious, that what differentiates someone that goes home feeling sick and recovers in a couple of days, are they filing for a claim too because they missed work because they went home, compared to someone who had to go to the hospital, more medical intrusions because of that? What differentiates that in this bill?
Through the chair, Representative McCarty. So of those 2,386 claims, we had 694 paid some type of benefit, and the vast majority of the claims that came in, they were reports. So the way workers' compensation works is if there was a report of injury. So we may have had somebody, for instance, at a business who tested positive, and Alaskan employers are extremely astute and we're very on point on taking care of this issue to contain the infection. And so they might shut down, send everybody to be tested. That would mean if they had, 10 employees or 1,000 employees, that would be that many claims, basically. And most of those would generate a zero bill. So that's why out of 2,386, we only had 694 paid. That being said, it was a fairly substantial amount that was paid, so benefits paid were, up to this point, well over $850,000 altogether in benefits. The majority of those were in, a few cases where medical procedures and especially medical transfer. So if an air transport had to be hired to bring somebody in from a remote site, that could easily be $50,000. And so, we got a pretty good sized bill on that for a very limited number of cases. So I hope that speaks to what you're asking.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, everybody. I think unless there's any other urgent questions, we want to set this aside for today. We still have some confirmations we want to get through, and I want to make sure that we are able to get through those that are scheduled here for today. Thank you very much to Representative Josephson and Elise Sorenberg for your presentation today. Thank you also to the members of the department who made themselves available and helped us get some answers to some questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to proceed back to, we're going to turn back to our appointments. Just a couple of announcements before we go back into them. One is that we're going to hear from appointees notice today with two exceptions. We're not going to hear from Mindy Swisher, who was an appointee to the Board of Social Work Examiners today because she had a scheduling conflict. She'll come back before us at another date. And then we also won't hear from Christina Durham, as we heard earlier today on the floor. She was an appointee to the Board of Psychologists and Associate Examiners, but she's withdrawn her name from nomination at this point in time. So we're going to, the plan is after talking with these appointees today, we will move them from committee on next Wednesday. If folks have any concerns with any of the appointees, please let the co-chairs know 24 hours before the next meeting, which where we'll take them up, and that is on Wednesday. So back to appointees, and also just as a reminder, you can always find all of the bill information, including the appointees on basis, at the AK Leg website. If you go to the House Labor and Commerce Committee, that's where all that information is available. We often send out email reminders, but if you're not sure where the documents are, you can always get those online at any time. All right, so our next candidate is Thomas Trosvig. I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, appointee to the Occupational Safety and Health Review Board. Mr. Trosvig, are you online?
Yes, I am.
All right, fantastic. If you can introduce yourself for the record and let us know why you're interested in this position and a little bit about your qualifications, that'd be great.
Okay, yeah, I'm Tom Trosvig, and I'm nominated to be renewed as the public representative to the Occupational Health and Safety Board. And just as background, I served 30 years in the U.S. Coast Guard, retired as a captain. I was a trained Marine casualty investigator. My specialty was marine safety. I served 12 years of sea duty, mostly in the Bering Sea, the Aleutian Islands, and the North Pacific. My shoreside specialty in the Coast Guard was marine safety. I was the former captain of the port at Coast Guard Group and Marine Safety Office, Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, where I was also in charge of all the ice-breaking operations on the northern Great Lakes. After retiring from the Coast Guard, my wife and I owned a business in Kodiak for 7 years, and for the past 16 years, I've been employed as the safety security manager for Matsa Navigation Container Shipping Terminal in Kodiak, where I deal daily with OSHA regulations. And I have been a resident of Kodiak. My wife and I have been residents of Kodiak for the past 43 years. And in addition, I've already served, I believe, 12 years on the Occupational Health and Safety Board. Why do I want to serve? Well, I believe I have a great amount of experience in the safety field. As a Coast Guard officer, I either compiled or approved casualty investigations at four major Coast Guard Marine Safety offices. And from my Coast Guard experience and that on the Occupational Health Board, I've gained further knowledge of safety requirements, especially pertaining to OSHA. Bottom line, I believe I have a wealth of experience, a good deal of common sense with relation to interpreting both state and federal regulations. Why do I want to serve? To contribute to the health and safety of our workforce. So that's my introduction. Questions?
Not your first rodeo. All right. Thanks, Mr. Trosvig. Are there any questions for Mr. Trosvig? All right, Representative McCarty.
So through the chair, just want to say thank you for your service in the Coast Guard and all that, being a former resident of Kodiak and knowing how that could be a dangerous place and how you did those things. Appreciate what you've done. Thanks for being willing to be a candidate.
Thank you, sir.
I think we all share that sentiment. Are there any questions from members of the committee that are on the telephone?
Hi, Chair Sunholzer, Snyder here.
Go ahead, Ms. Snyder.
Hi, thank you. Yes, thank you for your service. I'd like to echo that. I'm curious, in the time that you served on the board and then over the past year, could you speak a little bit to the lessons you think we've learned about workplace safety from the COVID-19 pandemic?
It was very interesting, the last hearing. We usually do the hearings in person up in Anchorage, sometimes in Juneau. I did one on Fairbanks, too, I think. But, yeah, we did this one over the telephone, and it actually went quite well. But as far as COVID, I think it's been a horror show for everybody. I mean, it's a horror show for me at work every day. I have to make sure everything is COVID compliant, and, you know, so we all have to deal with it. But what I've learned is, I don't know what the CDC puts out, and it seems to change from day to day.
You have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you. So I guess maybe one specific example, and I appreciate there are still details coming out, but I was, I'd like to know if you've been following what's been in the news lately with Copper River Seafoods and the investigation there. Did you have any thoughts on what the process should be?
You know, I have not, and we really, unless these come to an appeal to the OSHA or the ACOSH, Alaska OSHA Board, we don't get any inkling of it until we see the case. So I wouldn't be able to comment on that.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
All right. Are there any other questions for Mr. Trostwig? All right. Hearing none, I'm going to go ahead and open up public testimony. Is there any public testimony? No, looks like we don't have anybody on the line. I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. Thanks very much for coming in to talk with us today and for your service on the board. All right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, have a good night. All right. Next up is Enlo Walker, who's an appointee to the State Board of Physical and Occupational Therapy. Mr. Walker, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
All right. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and tell us a little bit about your experience and your interest in the board.
Okay. My name is Enlo Walker. I live in North Pole. I'm here for a reappointment to the Physical Therapy and Occupational Therapy Board. I'm a retired family practice physician. I was born and raised and educated in Pennsylvania, went to medical school in Philadelphia. My medical training was financed by an Air Force Health Profession Scholarship Program. And so after training, I was required to serve on active duty for several years. My first assignment was in Michigan. And then in 1983, I was transferred to Eielson Air Force Base, and we've been in Alaska ever since. After I completed my last several years of active duty service at Eielson, I went to work full-time at the Fairbanks Clinic in Fairbanks. And worked there continuously from 1988 through 2016 when I retired from active practice. Since that time, I've done a little bit of part-time medical work covering for my previous partners when they go on vacation and things like that, but I'm not actively practicing on my own anymore. I was initially appointed to the Physical Therapy and Occupational Therapy Board in 2018. And I'm currently serving as a secretary of that board. Over my years of practice as a physician, I had many opportunities to interact with physical therapy and occupational therapy, including supervising the physical therapy department for some of my years at the Fairbanks Clinic. And I feel that my experience has been beneficial to this board. I also serve on the State Advisory Board for Alcoholism and Drug Abuse since 2011, and I serve on the Fairbanks North Star Borough Health and Social Services Commission since 2018. In my off-duty time, I enjoy the many resources of this beautiful state, including hunting, fishing, exploring, traveling with the family, and so on. Thank you very much for your time, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us today and for your testimony. Are there any questions for Dr. Walker? All right, there's no questions, but I will just also thank you for your service on the Alaska Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. It certainly is a big issue in our state, as I know Representative McCarty is also keenly aware of. It's a costs us billions of dollars every year in terms of economic loss, but also a lot of hardship for our families, and the work that you do there is very important. So thank you very much for that. I'm going to go ahead and open this appointee up for public testimony. Is there anybody online who'd like to testify? All right, looks like we don't have anybody online who wants to testify. And with that, public testimony is closed. Thank you very much for your time tonight, Mr. Dr. Enla. Have a great Friday.
Thank you. All right.
Next up, we have Elizabeth Johnston, who is an appointee to the State Board of Registration for Architects, Engineers, and Landscape Surveyors. Ms. Johnson, are you online?
I am.
All right, fantastic. Can you introduce yourself for the record and tell us about your experience and interest in serving on this board?
Thank you. My name is Elizabeth Johnson. I live in Fairbanks, Alaska. I've been a registered electrical engineer since 2011. I've served on the Board of Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors since I was appointed in March of 2017, so this would be a reappointment for me. I am currently elected chair of the committee, previously having served as vice chair and secretary, and I am eager to continue my service. The board has several ongoing projects related to continuing education, military spousal, licensure facilitation, and public outreach that I would like to see completed during my term as chair over the next year. I guess that's it for me. Do you have any questions?
Yeah, you said that there's a couple of initiatives that are being worked on the board that you're interested in carrying through. You want to tell us a little bit about those?
Sure. So our licensees are on a two-year renewal cycle. Our first major project is related to continuing education. Architects, engineers, land surveyors, and landscape architects have to complete a certain number of continuing education units. And especially with COVID in 2020 and part of 2021, that's a good portion of this renewal cycle. So figuring out how to proactively reach out to licensees to remind them that they have continuing education that will be due in December of this year, and to facilitate them submitting their documentation in a way that can be efficiently reviewed is important, because especially with meeting remotely now, reviewing all the continuing education takes a good portion of the board's time, and figuring out how to do that more efficiently is important. The second example I mentioned is related to military spousal licensure. We have a good number of our board members that are interested in finding ways that we can facilitate a faster process. Our board does meet four times a year, but forcing a military spouse to wait 3 to 4 months for their application to be considered when they're up here for such a short amount of time sometimes is something we're looking to find ways to alleviate or fast track. So that's something we're ongoing. And we're aware that there is some legislation currently being considered this year that may assist with this matter. And the third is finding ways to reach out to the public, both our licensees and people that are affected by our licensees, such as the contractor community or builders that might be focused in non-licensed areas, such as home builders, and find ways to reach out to them to improve the public safety. We also have the bill being considered by the government on interior designer registration that the board is carefully considering how we could incorporate them into our board if they become a licensed profession.
All right, thank you. I also see that you are a two-time graduate of the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Yeah, that's correct. I have a master's in engineering management as well as an electrical engineering degree.
All right, it's great to see the university providing education for folks that go on to serve our community in important ways. Are there questions from other members of the committee for Ms. Johnston? Go ahead, Representative McCarty.
Through the chair, thank you for being here. Just kind of curious of what you're experiencing on the board currently with reciprocity of license and how that is flowing well or not flowing well.
Thank you for your question. So there are several national organizations that our board contributes to, and they do a lot to facilitate licensure. The National Council of Architectural Registration Boards has a process that they will give you what is called a record, and then you have a common set of information that can be transferred from each jurisdiction. The National Council on Engineers Examiners, also NCEES, has a similar one called a NC's record, and we're looking at ways to accept those records and have them reviewed in advance of the meeting, potentially by staff, and only have those Alaska-specific requirements, which right now is the passage of our jurisprudence examination and the Arctic engineering requirement that would then need to be checked. So that would facilitate licensure in a much faster manner by accepting those national sort of records. I hope that answers your question.
Follow up with that. So is that process being challenged because of statutes that don't recognize those, the entities of such, or is that just within the regulations or the board itself?
We believe it's within our regulations. We have created a regulation project that is going to create some language that makes it more explicit that we can accept those records. That's something we're working on.
Follow?
So it sounds like you're very informed what's going on with your board, so thank you for being willing to be a candidate again.
I would hope so. As the board chair, she should know what's going on, eh? Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time today and your willingness to continue to serve. I'm going to go ahead and open up public testimony. Is there anybody would like to testify? All right. There is nobody online who would like to testify. With that, thank you very much for your time tonight. All right, next up and last up this evening is James Rhodes, appointee to the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. Mr. Rhodes, are you online?
Yes, I am.
All right, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and tell us about your experience and you're interested in serving on the board.
My name is James Rhodes. I've been on the Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission since 2012. And one of the requirements to be on that commission is to have served on the Workers' Comp Board, which I did. I find it to be very educational, very rewarding, as well as challenging, and I think there's a lot of value in the amount of time you serve on that board or on that commission, because you're always learning, and the state Supreme Court's always coming back with some decisions that affect us, and we have to work around those. But it's been, like I say, it's been rewarding, and it's kind of my way of giving back to the system.
All right. Are there any questions for Mr. Rhodes? Any questions from members of the committee that are online? All right, hearing none, I'm going to go ahead and open up this nomination for public testimony. There is nobody online, so I'm going to close public testimony. And with that, thank you very much for your time today, Mr. Rhodes, and thank you also for your service to our state in this role. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, and with that, actually, we're going to take just a brief at ease. Today, we're we have reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointees as described below. Kelly Lucas, Board of Dental Examiners, Julie Endel, Board of Massage Therapists, James Henderson, Board of Pharmacy, and Tammy Lindemuth from the Board of Pharmacy. And this committee recommends forwarding the names to a joint session for further consideration. I just want to be clear, this doesn't reflect any intent by any member to vote for or against any of these individuals during a further session for the purposes of confirmation. I am going to ask members of the committee who are not in the room to come down and sign the committee paperwork after we gavel out. And then I want to, before we do that, I want to let you know that Co-Chair Fields and I would like for to follow sort of the standard procedure for introducing committee bills. This involves a motion pertaining to committee chairs draft legislation on behalf of the committee. Co-Chair Fields and I will use other members' discretion for introducing bills, and either co-chairs or staff will discuss bills ahead of time so as not to catch any committee members off guard. For an example, I think our first committee bill that we're interested in working on is an apprenticeship bill that has been discussed with members of this committee, both on and off the record. So with that, do we have a motion from Vice Chair Schrage?
Yeah, for the record, this is Vice Chair Representative Schrage. I move and ask unanimous consent that Representatives Sponholz and Fields, the co-chairs of the House Labor and Commerce Committee, be delegated the duties and responsibilities in AS 24.08.060A during regular and special sessions of the 32nd Alaska State Legislature. This delegation remains in effect until withdrawn by the committee.
All right. And before I ask about an objection, I failed to mention that Representative Fields, my co-chair, joined at 4:55. All right. Is there an objection to the motion?
So this is a.
Do you object for the purposes of discussion?
For discussion.
All right. Do you have a comment?
I'm just want to read the statute that was brought before to look at what that means for.
Would you like to take an IDs and read the statute? It's right up there on the wall. All right, we're going to take a brief IDs. McCarty, do you maintain your objection?
I'm just going to stay out on the record if the chair, mm-hmm. that I've read the statute of 24.08.060A, and what is being asked is already in statute, so there's nothing unique to that. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to retract my.
You're going to remove your objection?
Right.
All right. Mm-hmm. Is there any other objection? All right. With that, motion passes. And I go back to the bottom and make sure I don't miss anything that Megan is asking to talk today. All right, so thank you, everybody, for your time this evening. Looks like we're going to get done a little bit early, which is lovely. Please note that we will not be meeting next Monday. We're going to be instead having finance subcommittee during our typical time. Our next meeting is going to be on Wednesday, March 10th at 5:45. We're going to have a presentation on workplace safety in the seafood industry and have an introductory hearing for SB 24 related to virtual meetings for corporations. And this meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is now adjourned at 5:07 p.m. Thanks.